Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we'll go back to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight we will explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football
Memorabilia. Yeah.
I'm the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network, in conjunction with Swick Enterprises. We're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. And I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150 years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. It's at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He is a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show.
Captain, so happy to be here again. I've been having a little bit of football withdrawal the last couple of weeks.
Been a while, Joe. It's been a while. We're in March already, and the football card and memorabilia market never takes a break. It's 24/7, 365, as far as I'm concerned. There's never a day off from it.
You do. Yeah, you gotta really keep your wits about you. There's been times where I've missed a week of looking on stuff and then found out something I've been trying to find for a couple of years came up in that one time. So it's a little addictive, but yeah, I know, you know what I mean.
You gotta look at it 24/7, 365. You know, and
yep.
All kidding aside, I know a lot of people like you and I who basically do look at auctions, eBay, other sites looking for stuff. The use of stuff that we're trying to find. And again, like you say too, it's the one day we don't look at something, it's there.
Yeah.
And oops, it's gone.
Yeah.
But anyways, it's good to be back, good to be talking. Tonight we're going to have a open forum, and we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. And Joe, I'm going to have you lead off with talking about a real tough 1935 National Chickle card that's currently at auction. Lead it off.
Oh boy. PWCC, Brett, I believe his last name is pronounced Hugians, or Huggins, or whatever. Doesn't matter. PWCC has one of the hardest cards in the 35 Chickle set up for auction right now. A PSA 8, 1935 Chickle, card number 27, Flavio Bull Tosi. And I remember when I was putting this set together, that card was probably the most elusive card out there. Back then it was a pop 4 in a PSA 8. This one that just hit is the 5th in a PSA 8. It is by far the least populous Chickle card in the set. Real, real tough one. And I absolutely love seeing it come up. It's okay looking. Corners look good. Right side's a little on the light side, but hey, these things happen, you know.
Let me put you on the spot early in the program. Your theory behind why Bull is such a tough pick as far as in better grade.
You know, I've been on the hunt forever for an uncut chuck or uncut chicle, you know, sheet. Somebody the other day asked, like, what would you pretty much trade anything in your set for? And the answer was a 35 chicle uncut sheet. That would be the, you know, no matter what it takes, this thing's ending up in my collection. And
so should I pull out mine and send them to you and see what we can come up with?
Oh, Captain, if that was the case. But 36 cards in this set, and the other sets, you know, from this era, you know, the non sports sets, you know, made by Chickle, were all one sheet. So we imagine these were, you know, four rows of nine. Boltosi's number 27, which would put him in the lower left corner. That's my theory. Lower left corner, upper left, you know, any of the four corners, you know, get the crap kicked out of them, centering and et cetera, you know, just working their way through the machine. I'm looking right now at the population report. There are Luke Johnsus. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, but we'd have to get John Span on here to, you know, pronounce that properly. But has eight PSA 5s or five PSA 8s as well as Boltosi. But for some reason, mm-hmm. I've seen more examples of that. Boltosi is just, it's hard in any shape, in any grade. It's just a tough card. So,
you know, it's amazing to me because, again, I know we talked about this on shows previous to this. In a span of probably 25 years, it was probably a good – oh, actually, let me take that back. I'm looking at my notes now. My first chickle I picked up was back in 1988, and I put together part of the set on three separate occasions only to sell it off on three separate occasions. And I've never owned one Tozy card in all my sets I've been trying to put together. Yeah. I've never found one. And again, my stuff was raw, so I would have taken, you know, fair good for any high number. But I never saw one. I just never saw one. I've seen a couple graded, but I never saw one raw.
Wow. Yeah, it's tough. The only one I ever had in my set was probably about 6 or 7 years ago. I believe it was Legendary at the time, had a grouping of ungraded chickles that were thrown into a box. And as you're looking through the scans, I realized one of them was Tosi, and it was pretty high grade. It was good looking. So I bought the set. And, you know, to know what was in there, you would have had to really read the details and send it off to get graded and came back a solid PSA 5. I mean, it probably should have been
a
6. And I kept it. I mean, it was a really nice looking 5. But, yeah, tough, tough set. You know, for an example, there, you know, there's now 5 Boltosis. There's 5, you know, Luke Johnsus. There are 6 Nagurskis. So you talk about the rarity of Nagurski.
Right.
You know, the Tosi is even rarer than that. So I like to tell people with a wink and a smile, he's the Zeke Bratkowski of the 35 Chickle set.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously I could see Nagurski, but when you're looking at it, basically a common for a guy that really didn't have that great of a career and pay that kind of money in a, you know, in that kind of condition, I go, holy mackerel, you know, I don't know. It's tough to do. It's tough to pull the trigger on something like that. And that was always my issue with the 35 Chickles, because I always said to myself, okay, I basically am going to put the high number cards in much lesser condition. And I really didn't have any, you know, the couple high numbers I've had over the years would be lucky if they graded a PSA 2 or 3 at the most type of thing. So why put that kind of money in that kind of card? You know what I mean?
Well, Yeah, there are 4 days left on this auction, and it's already just broken the $4,000 mark.
Wow.
I reckon this is an $8,000 to $10,000 card. Depends on who's looking and when.
I would say I'd go out on a limb. I would say it might end up 10 plus with the premium on it and everything. I can really see that happening with that card. And what we'll do is when the auction is over, and the next time we have our podcast, we'll talk a little bit about it just to see where it ended up.
Yeah.
And we'll see how far off we were on with the book.
And then as we were talking before the show, PWCC has quite a few 48 Leafs. Looks like it's a set break of pretty high grade, sevens and eights. And then as I was going through, just clicking on them, I was just shaking my head. Just there's a Charlie Trippi, card number 29. That's a PSA 7. That is just so the sides are so trimmed. It's just it makes me smile and it makes me cry all in one fell swoop because it's just such a bad sting to the hobby to see a card
why can't they get their act together on these trim cards? Why? I mean, what's the problem? I really like to know. What is the problem for them to see that the card is obviously trimmed? It's a big ticket, card one way or the other. And there's no rhyme or reason as far as what's being greeted out there. It just really bothers me.
Ditto, and especially with the Leaf set, as we've talked about before, it's just that it's a set I still collect. I used to collect it in pretty high grade, and then I just saw the ruinization of the set with just high grade, obvious trimmed cards, and just knew it was diluting my set. So, and I now collect a set in PSA 5, 6, and 7, and just fat bordered beauties. I mean, I should almost change the name of my set to fat bordered beauties, but my favorite card in the set, the Charlie Choo Choo Justice. And I don't know why it's my favorite, but it's just, there's a PSA 8 up, but it looks like the left border's trimmed on it. And I refuse to buy something that's trimmed. My favorite card in a great grade, and it's trimmed. Charlie Choo Choo Justice. Wonder where he got that nickname. We need to do a show on
that. It's not right. It really isn't. And really, PSA really needs to address it one way or the other. I'm not going to stand on a soapbox here and lecture anybody. But, for the hobby itself and for people who are trying to buy grade, they're only concerned about grade, not realizing in this case, to me it's a false grade, to say the least,
Yeah, good point. No, there's a... It's tough. I was just going through, and I was watching. I probably have about 50 cards in this auction coming up that I'm watching, and one of them I'm interested in, and the other 49 I'm just more morbidly curious. It's too bad. Oh well.
That's crazy.
And then, like you and I were talking about, it's 'tis the season. It's auction house season. We've got about 6 auction houses lined up that are in the middle of auctions right now, or lined up, like airplanes taxiing to the runway, ready to take off. And I love this. You hear a lot of people talking about auction overload. No such thing to me. I love seeing the products coming to market, and I absolutely love getting the catalogs and the smell of the fresh ink. And got my REA catalog the other day. Got an email from Love of the Game talking about their up-and-coming auction, and BST sent out an email talking about some items coming up. So, I mean, you've got, the advertisements coming out and the catalogs being mailed. It's like Christmas in March. It's awesome for us football collectors.
Well, there's a lot of different arguments pro and con as far as, the number of auctions at one time, so on and so forth. We both get, and I'm sure most of our listeners get, the email from Auction Report, which gives a list of all the different auctions out. And I try to take some time looking at a few things, here and there. I don't go through every auction because I just don't have the time. But I look at it to a certain degree. You know, there is some overload on what's going on. And again, we talk about how many serious collectors are out there. We could argue,
yeah.
You know, there's thousands upon thousands upon thousands. Well, maybe there really isn't. It's just a small group of individuals who are bidding against one another for some of these, you know, better cards type of thing. For example, the Tozzi, you know, how many people are going to go up on that? Maybe a half a dozen? I don't know. I mean, it depends type of situation. So I understand where you're coming from, saying that it's, you know, it's a positive that all we're seeing all this different these different auctions here and there. But at the same time, you know, again, I said this for the past 2 years. Are we on overload? I mean, literally, there's so many different auction houses out there. Good grief! How do you really keep track of it? Type of situation.
I don't know. We touched briefly on this, but what's the name of that site? Auction Report. I really love Auction Report. They're not an advertiser for anybody listening, but it's auctionreport.com, and you know, the different auction houses. You know, advertise with them, and on the right-hand side are, you know, blue hyperlinks to the auction, and they're in chronological order of when they're ending, and it's just I kind of use auction. I mean, you know, they're friends of mine, you know, BST or you know, love the game. I go right to their websites, came you know, to save them click fees, you know, through there. But you know, everybody else, you know, it's great. I mean, so that's how I keep track of them, but. You know, what I do find myself doing is accidentally going to the same auction and, you know, traipsing through the, you know, the offerings several times. So I tend to keep a notepad, you know, at my desk at home where I kind of, Mile High is the next one up. It ends, you know, March 21st, which is tomorrow.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of make a list of what I'm bidding on, what I'm interested in there. So I don't forget about it and accidentally go through, you know, and start looking again. But, you know, yeah, Mile High's got a couple. They're always good for a couple really high quality items. We've got an SGC 96 yeah. Newt Rockne, you know, several PSA 857 tops cards, including the Unitas and others. So they've got a lot of 70s unopened, 78, 79, which I love. I keep getting enamored with. You know, I love the look of all this unopened. I just don't trust it. It's so hard. I'm so torn seeing all this unopened because I love it and it brings back a rush of memories. But you know, so many people we've talked to, you know, guesstimate about 50% of it's bad.
Exactly, and that's again the problem with the unopened market, which basically, you know, right now you only have one. Dealer technically who's the expert on unopened items, so you have to take his word on it, yada yada yada. And at the same time, you know, I look at some of the stuff I still have in my collection that's unopened and try to compare it to what I see if I go to a show or whatever type of thing. And it's tough. It's really tough. And you know, and when you're seeing rewraps of 81, 82 and 86 because of the rookies and those, you know, the Montana, the Rices, the Marinos, so, or 84 also, Elway and Marino. You know, there's something, there's something definitely wrong seeing that kind of stuff. That really doesn't make any sense, you know, other than to try to make a profit and pull a fast one type of situation. But
you see like a $50 card and you're like, that looks trimmed. Who the hell is out there wasting their time trimming a $50 card?
Right.
I remember asking a dealer that once. I'm like, well, why would somebody waste their time, you know, trying to trim, like, you know, a, you know, and you know, get a card from a, you know, a 5 to a 6 in 48 leaf, a, you know, $50 to $70 card. And he was like, well, if it takes him 10 minutes, and he turns a, you know, $5 card into a $50 card. So it takes him 15 minutes and he makes $40 on it. That's a pretty good hourly rate. And you know, I mean, assuming he's got to get graded, et cetera. So.
Yeah, it's a shame because it hurts the hobby in the long run. But at the same time, again, people or collectors who are desperate to put together an unopened pack run will do anything just to get that one pack. So on and so forth.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, it's just not worth it. It's just really not worth it, to say the least. And to me, there's no fun, and this is just me, seeing an unopened pack encapsulated, knowing that you're never going to break it open because, you know, you're going to lose all the value of what you paid for it in the first place. So that really doesn't make a lot of sense either. But it is what it is. It's the way the market is, and not much we can do about it other than really be smart as far as looking at something that's unopened or not unopened.
Yeah, totally.
That's the same, you know?
Totally. Yeah. But it is sad. It's like, I think we talked about this last week, but, you know, just the, gave you a 65 Philly pack, you know, for your birthday at the National,
yeah.
you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. Gosh, we're getting old. And, you opened it and you turned to me midway through, like, this is resealed. The poster was supposed to go like this, and it didn't. And, it was GAI encapsulated and graded, and it started to reinforce everything, you know.
Yeah. I hear you. It's the same thing, when finding a pack from the 60s, it has to be clean, and it is such a risk involved in it, it's not even funny. But again, like we said, it is what it is, and that's it. I still had a lot of good memories opening that pack that night, so it was definitely fun. I remember, and I don't think you were there, but you were there in Baltimore, and I opened a 76 wax pack, and I just got a bunch of commons out of it, and that was it. But I knew that was a good pack because I had bought it, and I just put it away for years, and I knew it was a good pack one way or the other. You know, I look back at it now, I could have put it out at a show and, you know, possible Peyton rookie, but, you know, it is what it is type of thing. And I vaguely remember when I opened up the 76 wax boxes, there weren't a lot of Peyton rookies in the box. I vaguely remember there was only like two or three because, again, he didn't become red hot until a few years later. And then I started going back into my inventory at the time and said, you know, I think I had maybe two or three. Obviously, one for my son. I had a couple of traders at the time. So, but it is what it is.
But some good, I'll rattle off a couple of the auctions coming up, you know, that we wanted to talk about. Mile High ends tomorrow, like I said. Some good 57 tops in there, some unopened. Huggins and Scott, which I really look forward to Huggins and Scott. I've always dug that building or that, that auction house. They're usually good for one or two, just like, holy crap, you know, where the hell did they get that card? Kind of thing. You know, I got my, I got my 46 Sears uncut sheet from them, about 5, 6 years ago. They sold a 49 Silbers, you know, YA Tittle card, which was the first one I'd seen of it. Scott doesn't have much coming up. Then ending on the same day, Robert Edward Auctions, the sparkle pony of the industry. REA's got a lot of good stuff. Whenever I see a 65 Topps Joe Namath rookie, I can't help but think of you, Captain. So they've got a PSA 8 Namath rookie coming up. 33 Sports King, PSA 8 Jim Thorpe and Red Grange. They're a little off-center, a little bit left to right, but still good-looking cards. Again, REA's got some really nice, uncut sheets, which, you know, everybody keep their hands off and calling dibs on it, just saying. And some unopened. I mean, it's a good swath of football, and REA, really leans baseball, so it's kind of nice to see them get some good quality football in, you know. Brian Dwyer out there pounding the pavement, you know, knuckle-dragging with us football guys. I like it.
Well, I really think eventually what's happening is the, as these auction houses evolve even more, mature more, they're still getting a lot more material in than they did before. So, and a lot more, and again, a collector stops collecting, he's trying to figure out where to go, where to get, you know, get the highest prices for his material. He may break up his collection to two to three auction houses. You never know, you know, that type of thing. So it's got to be broken.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's got to really be thought out for a collector, especially an advanced collector, who has the sheets, who has the, you know, the unopened material, who has the, you know, a PSA name it or has a whatever, PSA Bowman set type of thing. It's really got to be thought out as far as where they bring that material to and what they realistically think they're going to get for that material at the same time. So.
Yeah.
A lot of factors involved if somebody's selling their collection at the same time. And again, I've advised quite a few collectors over the years who are getting ready to sell, you know, advising them on what area and what they needed to look at and to do with that type
yep.
of thing. So that's important. It's important to say the least.
Yeah, and it's funny. I guess I never really, you know, whenever I have something I want to sell, I tend to reach out to the people that I know the best, I never really would have considered taking, a big collection and breaking it up to several auction houses. I guess I don't have that type of, you know, collection anymore. And I like having one throat to choke when it comes to, you know, all that stuff.
Right. So it's a big question. And again, with so many different auction houses out there, you really got to think about what you're going to do with it. I'll use one example just to throw it out. Several years ago, a couple of former Packers passed away, and they used a auction house in the greater Green Bay area to sell off their material. And to me, it was just so poor. It wasn't even funny because, again, the family didn't know what to do. The local people are there. They trust the local people. But, you know, if you didn't really, search, you would have no idea that the stuff was for sale. And there was a lot of nice stuff that really sold very, very cheaply because, to me, it wasn't advertised correctly and it wasn't going to a sports-type auction house. You know, you're talking about a general auctioneer trying to sell this stuff, and it's very difficult, even though they're local. You know what I mean? So it's an issue to say the least. So,
yeah, we've seen it before where people do send good material to the wrong auction house. Or, yeah, I guess you're right. I guess I've never really considered that. Is there a wrong auction house? Because it seems like, for me, like a prerequisite would be okay. You got to pop smoke on where the collectors go. You have to have a good mailing list, and you know, I mean, for me, almost the minimum playing stakes would be. You got to be on auction report. I mean, and, you know, I think you're going to see one of these days a lot of auction houses going away from printed catalogs, you know, or
that's because the cost of printing and the mailing of it is becoming, a true big expense now, especially with mail costs, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, somebody was telling me that they are going to start offering, if you have to go onto their website catalog.
Right.
And if you opt out of receiving a catalog, you get a $5 discount on shipping in the next auction.
Right.
You know, so, you know, that's pretty good. Because I'm to the point where I'm seeing auctions come up on auction report before I'm getting the catalog. So by the time I get the catalog, I've already checked the auction out. So perhaps if I received catalogs a little earlier, it might be of interest, but I've got a Memory Lane catalog sitting here on my desk unopened. Where's Memory Lane on here? March 16th, April 16th. Yeah, I've already looked at Memory Lane. So I guess I'm going to open this right now. See what we got.
Yeah, it's a question because it is much more expensive to print today, much more expensive to mail, especially. The mailing costs are gotten really high. I know mailing GG, Gridiron Greats Magazine, has increased with the last postage jump that we had. And again, you know, everything's a cost. You know, when you're spending a couple thousand dollars just on postage, you know, you got to try to make that up along the way. So being in business, we both know, you know, you can only absorb so much in costs, and that's it, without eating it into your business. So it's problematic.
Yeah.
I really don't have a problem
with online stuff, but I'll take it to the opposite. I know there's many, many older subscribers to Gridiron Greats magazine who tell me all the time and tell Brenda all the time, we look forward to getting the printed magazine in the mail 4 times a year. We enjoy reading it. We're not, you know, we're computer savvy, but we're not. But we don't want to, you know, sit in our favorite chair and curl up with the computer to try to read the magazine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's a real issue as the hobby grays and the hobby grows older. You know.
Well, and your magazine's a little different. And I wanted to comment with kind of a mea culpa. It costs a lot to ship Gridiron Greats, especially when your co-host didn't update his mailing address and you have to ship it twice. But I digress, Captain. Yeah, and for our listeners,
unfortunately, that happens a little too often, not just with you, but with other people. But I have many nice subscribers who write in advance or call me and just say, hey, I moved. I forgot to tell you. Just please let me know. That's really all I ask.
I've lived in my house for about almost 2 years, coming up on about 2 years. And it's been getting delivered, been getting forwarded, but it hits a spot where the post office stopped forwarding it. Especially when it's media like that. And so I got a text from Bob, hey man, mine got returned and I think we were talking about something else, like about, frustrations in the hobby. And also like, and this is frustrating. I'm like, gosh, that's great. I'm adding to the frustration of the ambassador of football. I definitely want to be on your good side.
You got it. Unbelievable.
But
moving to a slightly different subject and something we had talked about in the past. And I always wanted to have a show on TV which is similar to American Pickers, and I would call it, United States Football Pickers or whatever, something. And I would go around the country and pick for football and football-related items. So
yep.
As we both know, we share stories with all about our picks and everything.
Yeah.
And I know you know the story coming up now. A few of our listeners know it.
Yeah.
But I want to share it with people who don't know what happened. It's a good 2 weeks now ago, Brenda said, we were both off on a Friday, and she suggested we go to the Shoreline here in Connecticut to our favorite restaurant for a lunch. And we're about a good 40 minutes away from that part of the Shoreline, so on and so forth. So we left, and we're driving down to Clinton, Connecticut, Madison, Connecticut, that area. And I said to her, well, let me stop at that co-op antique shop in Clinton. Let me see if there are any things there. And for some reason, while we're driving down there, we're also talking about my father, who passed away quite a few years ago, whatever reason. So we get to the Clinton Antique Co-op, which is about, I would say, about 40, 45 different dealers. They have the setup with regards to the their material. They have, like, display cases. Some have it in the open, so on and so forth. And it's a pretty big area to walk around and look at stuff. Now, we probably go to that particular co-op 3 times a year. And I usually once a year hit on something, picking something. I found nice publications there over the years. A few odds and ends, odd stuff. So we go in there, we're walking around, and I find a dealer who has a bunch of publications there, all sorts of publications. So I end up picking from that dealer a 61 and 1963 Street and Smith football guide. I picked up a, not in great shape, a 1952 True Football Yearbook with Otto Graham on the front cover. And then I picked up something I honestly never saw before, I never even knew existed, was a giant, from Globe Publications, a giant puzzle book on football, fall 1976. It's the second copy in their run. and the front cover shows Joe Namath in Super Bowl III throwing over the heads of the Colts. So,
oh yeah,
I picked it up. I was amazed to see it, and in doing so, I picked those four up. And then what I did was to pick up at another booth, and I told you about this. It seems to be a piece of 1963 Topps football sheet that was a piece of printer's scrap. And the top row are six Redskin players, and the bottom row are six Cleveland Brown players. The numbers on the back of the sheet, and it's badly cut, are going from number 18, Jimmy Ray Smith, to number 23, Bob Gain. And then on the row on top of it goes from number 163, John Nisby, to number 168, Claude Crabb of the Redskins. And it's cut pretty bad, to say the least. But
yeah.
I thought it was an interesting piece, and I thought it would be a good conversation piece. And I know down the road, somebody like you or somebody else would be interested in it, and I would pass it on to the other person. What's interesting to me is that at the same co-op, maybe, and I didn't have time to look in my notebook, probably 6 or 7 years ago, I bought three strips of 1960 Fleer football cards, almost the same type, only there were seven in each row of these of one sheet, and the other sheets were like 10 card strips. And I was just amazed to see them because I'm saying, again, this must be printer's scrap, and I don't know where they came from. You know what I mean? So I thought it was an interesting pick. But here was the kicker, although it's not football related. I look at a lot of yearbooks when I go to antique shops or paper shows. I especially look at college yearbooks to see if there are any well-known college players, football players in the book, so, and I'll pick them up. But in this antique co-op shop, there's one dealer that always has had a lot of yearbooks. And for whatever reason, I'm looking through them, and then I see a 1939 Elm City yearbook. And I said to myself,
oh, yeah,
that's my father's yearbook. He graduated in 1939 from Hull House High School.
Oh,
so sure
gosh.
Enough, I pull it out. I know it's not his yearbook because my sister has his yearbook. And I opened it up, and I see my father signed the yearbook for the gentleman who owned it. And I remembered immediately the yearbook because I looked at it when I was a kid for many years. And my father signed his name, for whatever reason, Walter von Swick, which made no sense to me, but I just found that very interesting. So I went up to the counter with all my picks, started talking to the two guys behind the counter, and I explained to them this was my father's yearbook, yada, yada, yada. I showed it to them. I showed them my driver's license for them to know that I am a Swick also. And they couldn't get over it, so then we ended up talking about it when I was saying my father, shortly after he got out of high school, ended up joining the Army for World War II. And I didn't get home until 1945. So it was a pretty interesting story. And
what did he sign the yearbook
as? Something which was cute. I said, no, I'll pay the price on it. It's nothing. He said, no, we got to give you a discount on it. And it was funny. But I always like going to the unknown, like antique or paper shows, more so than card shows, because you really never know what you can find at those
I hate to ask this, Ken Captain. What did he sign the yearbook as?
Walter von V-O-N Swick. It made no sense to either me or my sister, but I vaguely remember, for whatever reason, he was nicknamed, for some reason it sticks out of my mind. My sister remembered it too. Some guys used to call him Von Swick for the way he looked. He had a full head of hair. He looked very dapper when he was younger. So that might have been his nickname. I have no idea. I'll never know either. So it's, It was just fascinating to me to see.
And you obviously just found this, so there's, you know, no way to figure out what's your dad's real name.
Well, it was Walter Swick, Walter Harry Swick. So I don't know where he got the Von from. So,
but it was an interesting read to say the least. But
well,
have
that's
you got
pretty
any,
cool that you found. Yeah, that's really cool that you found. A yearbook from your dad, and he'd signed it.
Yep. It just amazes me, to say the least. Amazes me.
It's really
you got
cool.
any good picking stories over the years?
I know my place in this hobby of ours, Captain. I've been to many, many nationals where people, you know, where the idea of a good time for people is to pull a chair up to the dollar card bin and sift through it looking for that diamond in the rough. That is not my place in this hobby. I'm at the bottom of the food chain. There's the people who find the card. There's the people who grade the card. They sell it to a dealer who then sells it to me. I'm happy to admit I'm the consumer who walks into, you know, Best Buy and buys a boombox. My stories of finding, you know, gems in the rough at shows are mostly trade secrets. I think I've told you like 5-6 years ago, I was collecting the 57 top set in PSA 8, and I was collecting the Zeke Gradkowski card. And about 5-6 years ago, I ended up buying an uncut sheet of 57 tops from Huggins and Scott, I believe. And in the top left corner, the pole position was Zeke Gradkowski. So I know why his card is so tough. But unless you collected that set, or you were a Pittsburgh, you know, fan, you'd never heard of Zeke Gradkowski. So I spent an entire national once just walking up to every football set, you know, every football, you know, a booth. You have 57 tops, you know, Raws. And I would go through and I would find every single Zeke. And then I'd look at it like, is this a 7 or an 8? And I ended up buying about a dozen of them. Back at the bar, you know, on a Friday, and, you know, we're exchanging war stories, and a dealer friend of mine said, what'd you get? I'm like, well, I bought these Zekes. You know, and who the hell's Zeke? Yeah, exactly. I ended up telling him the story. And the next year, he beats me to the national by like 2 days. He's, you know, the dealer opened, you know, at, you know, Tuesday, and then, you know, checking the floor Wednesday.
Right.
And then Thursday afternoon, I get there, meet him up, and he shows me a handful of Zeke Gradkowskis that he picked out. And I was like, damn it. Okay. No more trade secrets to dealers. And he got a PSA 8 out of one of them, which kind of frustrated me. So my diamond in the rough was usurped by a dealer. I mentioned I found a bolt hosey, you know, in an auction, but, you know, that's not really my station in life. My station is to have a dealer reach out to me and, hey, I just bought this bolt hosey at a legendary. It was raw, and I, you know, cleaned it up a little bit, gave it a bath, got it graded, and here she is. You want to buy it? And I say, hell yeah. And I'm good with that. I have more important things. I'd prefer to play golf with friends or hang out with friends, you know, at a national or even just it's relaxing to hang out at the BST booth, just to hang out. Plop myself in front of a middle-aged, you know, grumpy old man selling cards, you know, who doesn't speak a word to me, and sitting there for 20 minutes sifting through cards that have been sifted through 100 times. And yeah, I don't know. I floor and glance, and if I see something that attracts me, then I pull into the, you know, then I'll, you know, yeah, you know what I mean. So,
right.
Yeah.
It's interesting because when I was in with Jeff Payne and the guys at the Valley Forge show, we actually walked at, you know, we're at dealers' booths where there was not even an acknowledgement, and you got four guys staring at cards. You think he would, you know, the guy would say, can I help you with anything? You want to look at anything? You know, and we're like looking at him, and like we're saying too, you know, we shouldn't be the first ones trying to make the move here. Just why don't you guys, you know, be friendly? You know, you probably would sell half your inventory there, type of thing. But I do agree with you. You know, it's tough being a dealer, seeing people just, you know, pull the seat up and then they go and spend 2 hours with a $3 sale, you know, that type of situation. But that's the way our hobby is. That's it. Nothing can do about it. So,
yeah. Yeah.
That
happens. I don't mind that. I don't mind that. I'm certainly not jealous or envious of the person who, you know, sees me in the bar afterwards. They're like, hey, check this out. I mean, if it's a Jim Thorpe postcard, I'm going to be pissed. You know, but if it's, hey, check this out. I found this Unitas, you know, in a BGS 7, and I'm pretty sure I can crack it. And, you know, I just did it and, you know, got an 8 out of it. My first thought is congratulations. You know, you've got the diligence.
Yeah, sure.
You've got the discipline to do that. I do not. So, you know, and I'm good with that. I like looking through, you know, catalogs. And you know what? I've got a good enough relationship with enough people in the hobby that I'm lucky. I get phone calls. I'm you know, top three on a phone call list. You know, hey, I found this at a whatever. I got it graded, or, you know, here it is. It's very rare. You know, I want X for it. You know, do you want it? You're the first person I reached out to. Yes, I will take it for X. Thank you for calling me, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
If you're fair, if you don't, you know, go back and forth on a price too much, if you're cool to the person, then generally they'll keep calling you. That's what I like.
And unfortunately, you know, we see a lot of hammering of the price and, you know, a $100 card, well, I'm only going to give you $30 for it, type of thing. Well, you know, don't be ridiculous in your offers. And I see a lot of people do that, and it's just not a good thing. And hopefully, people realize that, you know, the person behind the table there is there trying to actually A, sell inventory, and B, has to make a profit to cover all his expenses, which may include transportation, overnight food, the cost of the cards themselves, so on and so forth. So it's not any, you know, it's not easy doing it one way or the other. But I still enjoy going to antique shops, antique shows. I still enjoy going to paper shows because I do see, you know, since I do like publications, I do find from time to time interesting publications and or postcards and the like from those types of shows. And I know I've done several times the Paper Mania show here in Hartford, Connecticut, and it's definitely a different crowd that attends those types of shows. For example, the last time I was in Hartford set up, I had a gentleman who basically looked through every Sports Illustrated I brought there, and I asked him, are you a collector? And he says, I just collect the ads. I don't collect the magazines. So a lot of those magazines, he was basically just going to slice up and take the ads out of them because he wanted the ads, which I find very interesting. But that's a whole big market there, too, that individuals do that.
Yeah.
They find the old magazines, there's 7 or 8 ads that they want for their collection, and they slice it up that way, which is very interesting.
You know, probably like 13 years ago, you know, when I first started getting into the Hall of Fame set, I was really active on the registry. This is back before your eBay ID was blanked out, so people knew who were picking up cards. I just discovered PSA website, so I was, you know, like I said, active on the boards, the message boards there. And there's a guy, I'll never forget, there's a guy just kind of, you know, the banter back and forth, you have fun, and eventually it's like, you know, hey, you know, what's your phone number? Give you a call. And you end up talking to a lot of people. And at one point, the top 20 people on the registry, I had the phone numbers for like 16 of them. And would talk to about 8 or 9 of them, you know, actively. I mean, I'm still friends with a couple of them. One guy lives in Australia, and last year my family and I went to Australia, and I stayed 4 days at his house. You pick up good friends. And one guy wanted to sell. He reached out to a guy who, you know, to buy him, and the guy lowballed him. So he called me, and it was, you know, some good mid-range cards, but pretty rare. And I remember, you know, the guy, like, you know, oh, I wanted, you know, 3,000 for him, and he offered me, you know, 2,400. And this and this. And I'm like, I think they're worth $3,000. I'll give you $3,000. Really?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I appreciate it. They're great cards, man. You just saved me a bunch of time. Yeah, they're worth $3,000 all day long. And by the time the other guy had gotten back to him, like, okay, I'll give you $2,500. You know, he got the satisfaction of saying, never mind. Never mind. Somebody gave me $3,000. And I got the cards, and I was happy with them. And about 9 months later, the guy came forward, and he goes, hey, I'm going to sell off my other cards. I gave you first crack at them. And I bought those too, and he gave me a deal. This time he gave me a deal. And it's just, I've always subscribed to that. You know, be cool, be fair, be gracious and be respectful about it. Yeah, like you said, the other end of the living. And it's a hobby, but you don't need to buy every card at the lowest and sell it at the highest. You know, sometimes, you know, you got to walk away with that win-win. And I just, every time I do that in a hobby, I just make another friend. And it gives, I have people who, you know, probably about 8-9 times a year just call me with, you know, hey, I picked up this Thorpe thing. You want it? Hell yeah, I want it. What's your price? You know, $2,000. Okay, that might be $100 high, but in the entire scheme of things, $100. The guy reached out to me and gave me first whack at it. So $100. Yeah, right. Absolutely. Right. You know, and it's just, it's almost paid off in time for me.
It's almost like we need a hobby etiquette lesson for some people. I mean, I see it all the time. I've done shows for 30-plus years now, almost 40 years. And I've seen it all the time. And I think when the explosion of football cards hit from 89 up, it was like, it was a free-for-all. And I can't tell you how many times I had dealers come up to me or dealers call me, hey, listen, I'll trade you some 89 Pro Set for your 66 Phillies. And I would say, why would I want to do something like that? I mean, that makes no sense to me whatsoever. And it was always, well, you know, this is hot. You'll make your money on it. I said, I'm not going to make any money on it, type of thing.
Yeah.
So it was not a good situation, I want to say, from roughly 89 to 92 in the respect that I think a lot of material was mishandled, meaning that it was very underappreciated dollar-wise, and the newer stuff was overappreciated dollar-wise, only to see it today being worth, you know, $3-4 at a show for, pro set, or say 89 tops black, which is a literally worthless type of situation.
Well,
so it impacts that. It impacts the hobby in the long run because, you know, somebody who may be starting a collection at that time will say to themselves, well, this is a screwed up hobby. Everybody's just trying to take advantage of everything. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, you know.
So it's
kind of settled down, in my opinion. But, again, it's a valuable lesson for everybody to really understand. You know, there is a lot of time and money invested. So, you know, be respectful of what you offer. Type of situation,
yeah,
and that's important to say the least.
No, and I can remember once looking for a card and just traipsing through the internet and finding this obscure guy in Pennsylvania, and I can't remember his name, but really, really nice guy, and I bump into him at the National all the time. We had him as a guest probably about 6 years ago, Bob, and just found his website, called him. Yeah, you got these 5 ticket stubs I want. Yeah, they're still available. Okay, you have all 5 of them listed for, you know, 600 total. You know, what can you do? That was 550, son. That sounds very fair. That's what I was thinking. Perfect.
Yeah.
How about I send you a check to save on fees? Yeah, that'd be great. I'll give you free shipping if you send me a check. That sounds very fair. Thank you. I appreciate that. Check went in the mail, and he got the check. And he's like, thanks, received it. I'll ship it off. It's just that kind of mutual respect. I don't know. I just, I'm big on that stuff. And I find that the world repays you in kind, you know, if you do that. And, to this day, that guy still reaches out to me and, about once a year now, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I believe it. All right. We're almost out of time. We got about 4 minutes left. We're going to go into our 2-minute warning and wrap up. Just one quick mention, our spring issue of Gridiron Greats magazine will be out the week of April 11th. And we've got a couple interesting articles coming in, especially on the old Denver Mile High Stadium. And we're also going to be looking at Martin Jacobs has a phenomenal, interesting article on paper, football paper. So I'll leave it like that. And it's a very, very, very interesting article, say the least. We've got a couple other articles in, which I'm sure everybody would be interested in. If you are not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, but you are a listener, go to our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com, and become a subscriber. Four issues, $29.95, long, long shelf life for your magazine as a reference tool and also as a very, very informational piece for the football hobby.
What is the cutoff for getting sending you articles that get into the next Gridiron there, Captain?
As soon as possible. But in your
I'm always working on a couple articles, and I always I'm always behind the eight ball, aren't I?
we'll talk about it later. Don't worry about it now. But yeah, that's coming up. And again, we also have online on our website. If you don't have any issues of Gridiron Greats magazine, you can buy our entire back run from issue 23 to our current issue at the scheduled price there. If you're interested, contact me on that. I'll be more than happy to help you out on it. But that's what's coming up as far as our next issue of the magazine is concerned. After that, obviously, it's going to be the national issue, and we've got a few surprises coming into that upcoming. Well, Joe, we're almost out of time, and we had a good discussion tonight on auctions, picking, the hobby in general, and I just never get tired of talking about football cards and football memorabilia and football history. I just think it's one of the neatest things to talk about. I just thoroughly enjoy it. And I also want to briefly mention the Alliance of American Football is playing. And I enjoy watching it when I get a chance, when I can pick it up over here. It's a pretty interesting league. It should be a good minor league for the NFL, if that's what they're going to use it for. Hopefully it'll be around for a few years. I know they're having some financial issues, but hopefully they can iron it out. And I'll tell you, if I was close to one of those stadiums and they were playing, I'd definitely be a season ticket holder. And I'd be there for every game enjoying it, to say the least. I got all the teams following my Twitter feed, Bob at Gridiron Great Magazine. And it's pretty interesting to read their stuff and to see what they're talking about. But it's a good league. I enjoy it. I enjoy watching them.
I'll stay mum on that. I don't think I've watched a game.
That's all right. So, it was funny.
Yeah.
The opening weekend, they were on the local CBS channel here in Connecticut, and it was fascinating to watch. I mean, it just brought back so many memories of me years ago watching the World Football League when I could on a grainy black and white TV out of New York, with me missing half the game because the connection failed. And then fast forward to the USFL, 83, 84, and 85. I loved watching the USFL. I just thought it was great. I thoroughly enjoyed that league, to say the least. All right, we're almost out of time. We're going to be back hopefully next week with another show with a guest, and we'll be talking about that later. Joe, thanks for being on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Captain. Always a pleasure to be on.
All right, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Ba, 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 ba.